This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We have a Civil Rights Act, we have a Voting Rights Act, and then, like, all's good. Right? And I think when we follow the actual Rosa Parks, we see that the movement and its issues continue because many things have not been resolved, and so she continues on. Right? And so there's another picture in the book of her picketing outside the South African embassy in the 80s, right? She's sort of a longtime opponent of apartheid and of kind of U.S. complicity in the sort of South African apartheid. And so here we have her in her 70s picketing outside the South African embassy against apartheid.
Historian Jean Thea Harris, author of the new book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. The book is just out 100 years ago today. Civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks was born. It was February 4, 1913. On December 1, 1955, at the age of 42, she refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white man in Montgomery, Alabama. She was arrested and convicted of violating the state's segregation laws. Her act of resistance led to a 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system that led ultimately to a Supreme Court decision desegregating that system. She helped spark the civil rights movement and launch Dr. Martin Luther King. Today, the U.S. Postal Service is releasing a commemorative Rosa Parks Forever stamp. You can go to our website to read a section of the book and to read my column, Rosa Parks, Now and Forever. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. Happy birthday, Hugh Grant. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Monte, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:04. Coming up next is more talk radio with host Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Daphne Wisham, founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network.
February 1st, 2013. A slightly under the weather KBOO Navigator report. Two grants were submitted this week that, if funded, will support the digitizing of thousands of reel-to-reel tapes from the vast KBOO archive. You can hear samples of these priceless audio recordings on two KBOO monthly programs, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, and Treasures from the Archives. An emerging partnership with Portland Community Media will bring KBOO to television audiences. In-studio videotaping of program hosts, interviewees, and musicians will be broadcast on various cable channels. The first program to be featured will be Buscando America. Stay tuned for details on when you can watch KBOO on TV in the near future. Planning is about to begin for KBOO's 45th birthday party. If you would like to help and are excited about fundraising, sponsorships, marketing, and coordinating major events, please come to the development meeting February 4th, 6 p.m. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch at 503-231-8032 or navigator at kboo.org. Thank you.
This is Gareth from Music from the True Vine inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs. My fellow Music from the True Vine hosts and I will be performing as the True Vine Ramblers and bringing you a great set of traditional bluegrass music. Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends striking up some old-time fiddle tunes, and Noontime Jamboree host Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing some swing. Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m. Doors open at 6 p.m., so plan on arriving early, as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea. There will also be a silent auction and raffle items to view. For full details, go to the KBOO website at kboo.fm and click on Once in a Boo Moon under Coming Events. All proceeds...
I know it's songs to daddy's dumb, but trying to think of what you want. KBOO
Radio is proud to help Zippity News and a clothes drive to help clothe the homeless. We will be collecting gloves, hats, and scarves until February 15th, when the clothes will be distributed throughout the homeless community. KBOO is located on 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Thank you, and we hope to see you donating clothes to help keep the homeless warm this winter.
You are listening to KBOO FM in Corvallis 100.7, in Hood River 91.9, and in Portland, Oregon 90.7. My name is Cecil Prescott, and this is More Talk Radio. Today is Monday, February 4th, 2013. And before we begin our program, let me share with you one other announcement. There is a rally today for universal health care in Oregon, concerning legislation to bring universal health care to our state. It's being reintroduced by Representative Michael Denbrough of Portland. And the rally will be on the steps of the state capitol in Salem. A march begins at 10:30 from the capitol, returning at 11 a.m. And the rally begins on the steps of the capitol at 11:30 a.m. This event is sponsored by Healthcare of All for All Oregon, a statewide organization with about 60 member organization. That's today in the state capitol. We the people still believe that our obligation as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult, but America cannot resist the transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure, our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. This is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God. That's what will lend meaning to the creed our fathers once declared. And with those words, the president spoke about climate change in his inaugural speech, a topic that was ignored during the recent presidential campaign. Our guest, Daphne Wisom, believes that this is an opportunity for climate change activists to push for meaningful action. Ms. Wisom is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. I'm having difficulty reading this morning. We invite your participation by calling and responding to these queries. How do you think the president should address climate change? And while the president has uttered the words climate change, the GOP leadership team, including Oregon's Greg Walden, oppose any legislation that may include increased revenue, the so-called carbon taxes. What do you say to your recalcitrant neighbor and Congress to convince them to take decisive action on climate change? Thank you, Ms. Wisom, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we might begin by having you share something you wrote a few months ago about our nation's inability to grapple with climate change in an op-ed piece that was published in a number of publications, including the Huffington Post. You wrote an article that was entitled "The Six Stages of Climate Grief." Is our nation in a state of transition?
I think we are in a state of transition. I think that it's becoming increasingly clear that climate change is not only happening, it's getting more and more intense, it's exceeding a lot of the scientific predictions of just how rapidly it would unfold. And the column that you referred to, The Six Stages of Climate Grief, you know, a lot of people are familiar with the sort of five stages of grief that have been discussed by a number of therapists and others. Namely, you know, the first stage is essentially disbelief, where you're in denial, you don't want to accept that perhaps a loved one has died. The second stage generally is anger, and what I tried to do was go through these different stages and compare them to the different stages of acceptance versus grief versus eventual acceptance in terms of climate change. And I think what we're seeing, especially thanks to the likes of Fox News and others that have been fueling the denial of climate change, is that there are quite a few both elected officials and people in the American public that are in denial about just how severe climate change is and what it means in terms of the kinds of changes that we're going to have to make in our lives. And I think our politicians are prolonging this denial stage by rarely uttering the words climate change. Even Barack Obama, as he was running for president, rarely uttered the words climate change. It took Hurricane Sandy and a Republican governor in the state of New Jersey and others to finally say, look, it is, in fact, climate change that's happening. Hurricane Sandy is clearly a manifestation of intense, the sort of intense energy that's now part of our atmosphere that's manifesting in severe storms, severe droughts, and so on. So thankfully, Obama, in his inauguration speech, did place climate change front and center. However, we are continuing to see others like Rush Limbaugh, like Sean Hannity, continue to deny that climate change is upon us. And, you know, as a result, the American public is somewhat confused. And I think, you know, once we get through the different stages of grief, of dealing with just how severe this crisis is, we can get to what I think is the final stage, which is not acceptance, but actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just out in Portland last week, yes. And I was so impressed with all of the work that's being done in the state of Oregon on energy issues, on climate issues. In many ways, the rest of the country has so much to learn from what it, all of the various experiments that are underway in the state of Oregon. I heard, for example, that in one county, I believe it's in western Oregon, people are actually getting paid $500 a year or so just to live in the county. Why? Because they have developed a successful wind program. And they're doing something comparable to what has been done up in Alaska with the Alaska Permanent Fund, where residents of Alaska are paid just to live in Alaska by the oil companies. Well, in this case, it's the wind companies that are providing payments. I don't know if you know about this, but this was news to me, and it seems like this sort of model of providing financial compensation to communities is one way of bringing people on board the clean energy future and ensuring that people see it as in their interest to pursue the clean energy options that are going to get us out of this bind that we're in right now.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Our guest this morning is Daphne Wysom, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Study and the founder and co-director of Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We ask you to call and respond to the question, how do you think the president should address climate change, and what do you do to... What do you say to your recalcitrant neighbor, Congress, to convince them it's time to make decisive action? Joanne is on the line. Good morning, Joanne.
Yeah, hello, Cecil. I was listening to Democracy Now! And realized Rosa Parks and my mother were born in the same year. But, you know, I keep, this is not your folks, but I keep getting mad year after year, realizing that a lot of history and information we should have about our country and that is not in elementary school or high school, even now. And I just keep getting mad that my grandchildren and I have been, and children, have been deprived of this information and other people. So I know this is not your focus. But while I'm still able to speak, I want to get it out there, and thank you for letting me say it.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. Well, while that's not our focus, perhaps our focus could be in terms of the point of how do we get it involved, the issue of climate change in our schools and in the curriculum. I don't know whether or not you could address it,
sure.
But please.
Yeah, in fact... you know, this is an issue actually very close to my heart, is how are we teaching our children or not teaching our children, both about the past, as the caller mentioned, and the proud historic past that we have in terms of, you know, the civil rights struggles and all sorts of movements for social change, which are absolutely critical to our future, but also how are we teaching about the issue of climate change. Mm-hmm. What are we telling our students in schools about this absolutely critical issue to their future? Unfortunately, the pattern right now is either silence when it comes to climate change, or continuing to push this the climate denial approach. And in fact, there's an organization by the name of ALEC, A-L-E-C, which mm-hmm. people may have been maybe familiar with in regards to a very conservative agenda. It's pushed forward conservative candidates for office throughout the country. They also have an agenda of pushing climate denial in the schools mm-hmm. and also rolling back renewable energy standards in states around the country. They're clearly an arm of the Koch brothers, the billionaire Koch brothers who've made their money off of the oil and gas industry, among other very powerful industries in the U.S. and Canada. They're helping to finance the Keystone XL pipeline, that is to bring tar sands from Alberta down to Texas, unless it's stopped. And so they have a very clear agenda, which is to keep our students in the dark on an issue that is going to be facing them over the next century. And I just want to say a couple of things about what we know about the climate science right now. Mm-hmm. There was a report that was just released in January, early January. It's called the Draft Climate Assessment, and it was released on a Friday, so Friday afternoon is a perfect mm-hmm. time to
drop.
Release information if you want it to be ignored. So a lot of people didn't get the information that was included in this study. Essentially what it says is that we are going to see a 9 to 15 degree Fahrenheit warming over most of the U.S. over the next century. Now, how many people picked up their newspaper on Saturday or Sunday or Monday, January 11th, and saw this news spread on the front page? I doubt anybody in Oregon or anyone around the country woke up to that news. And yet that is the devastating truth, that we are on a track to a 9 to 15 degree Fahrenheit warming over most of the U.S. over the century. And what that means is essentially almost the worst case scenario. It's not quite the worst case scenario, but it's a track of 940 parts per million CO2 by 2100. That's almost a doubling, if not, it's actually more than a doubling of where we are right now. So this is unacceptable. This is absolutely unacceptable, because what it will mean is really global instability, the likes of which we've never known. So I encourage people, if they want to learn more about this, there's an excellent summary of this up on a website called Climate Progress, mm-hmm. and the story is entitled End Climate Silence Now, Draft Climate Assessment Warns of Devastating 9 to 15 Degree Fahrenheit Warming Over Most of the U.S., and it summarizes this very lengthy report, which is over 1,000 pages long. So that's really what we are not being told either by our news media, or by our politicians, nor by, of course, by our teachers in our schools, especially with this pushback from ALEC and others. What can people do about this? One thing I would encourage young people in particular to do, if they are courageous enough to do so, is to encourage their schools, their teachers, to begin to talk about the climate science, the state of climate science right now, and to get informed, especially if they are teachers, to get informed on this. If they're science teachers, they definitely need to be informed on the current state of climate science, and to be focusing on solutions, which are, of course, much more empowering than the dire state of the climate science. And, of course, this 9 to 15 degree Fahrenheit rise is not inevitable. We can change the trajectory, but we do need to make those kinds of changes very rapidly, i.e. in the next 5 years or so, if we're going to bring that curve, that rise in temperatures and greenhouse gas emissions, if we're going to curve it downward instead of upward.
Yes, yes. You are listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Our guest this morning is Daphne Wysom, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and founder and co-director of Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. The president spoke about climate change at his inaugural address. Ms. Wysom believes that now is an opportunity to push the president and our representative for decisive action. We invite your calls here at 503-231-8187 and respond to the question, how do you think the president should address climate change? And what do you say to your neighbor and congressional representative that this is an important issue and that change is needed? Let's go to Mark. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that the Dow has reached 14,000 once again, and it hadn't been at that since before the financial crisis of 2008-2009. So Wall Street is humming, but that 14,000, which is what the business community seems to like, or better than that, is incompatible with saving the planet. We're not going to maintain that robust an economy with the level of waste and heedless exploitation of limited resources. We can't do that forever and have that nice 14,000 hum with Wall Street. It's really a situation of it's your money or your life. We're going to have to do more with less. It's going to be a belt tightening, and that's anathema to the political culture. It's anathema to the business culture. I want to leave you with a quote from President Obama a few weeks before the inauguration. He said, and this was in the New York Times, "If we're going to avoid jobs and growth simply to address climate change, I don't think anyone's going to go for that. I won't go for that." I want to repeat the key word here, simply. If we're going to avoid jobs and growth simply to address climate change. Well, right there you see where the priority is for climate change. It's an issue. The president acknowledges it. It's an issue. But it's, when you use the word simply, it's basically as if a doctor told you, you need to smoke, you need to stop smoking simply to save your life.
Right.
Or I won't stop smoking simply to save my life.
Excellent.
So, I think it's an illusion to think that if we build wind turbines, if we drive Priuses, if we install fluorescent light bulbs, that the American way of life as we know it can continue at its current pace. In order for the American way of life to be possible for everyone on Earth, which seems to be the goal, it would take something like 4 or 5 additional planet Earth resources.
So I think I think we gathered your point. I want Ms. Weisham, and thank you so much for calling, Mark. So how do we deal with this notion that is pronounced in our country that the so-called American way of life needs to be saved, regardless of how it impacts other people? And how do we counter that dominant view that it's our job or our planet?
Well, I mean, I think the caller is correct that Obama does, you know, on the one hand, he seems to understand that climate change is a crisis. What he doesn't recognize yet is that it is the crisis. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem that has faced us time and time again, is that we have politicians who are thinking in 4-year or 2-year increments, mm-hmm. and not, you know, 100-year or 200-year increments, which is what we really need to be thinking when we're thinking about climate change, because it is, in fact, a crisis that is upon us, but it's going to get worse, much worse, unless we really take the long view. And so Obama's policies, by and large, have a sort of short-term potential to improve the lives of you know, Americans beleaguered by the economic slump that we're in. They are not sufficient to tackle the long-term problems that we face. And one of the things that the Institute for Policy Studies is working on right now, we have a project called the New Economy Working Group, mm-hmm. which essentially says, you know, the old economy is dead. We're looking at a new economy that is very dissimilar to the economy that we've become accustomed to. It mm-hmm. does, in fact, include a downsizing of sorts, mm-hmm. but it also includes things like promoting fairness mm-hmm. and greater democracy and greater equality, and also making sure that we're addressing things. For example, one of the problems in the American way of life is the considerable amount of waste mm-hmm. that we have, that waste that ends up leaching into our groundwater or into our air with incinerators. We could be recycling far more than we're recycling right now. We could be creating more jobs in that industry than we are right now. Another thing that is essentially that must be transformed as we address the climate crisis is agriculture. Mm-hmm. There are far more sustainable ways for us to be growing our food that could also help us sequester carbon in the soil. These sorts of ideas, as well as working on issues around greater economic fairness, are issues that are being tackled by this group, the New Economy Working Group. We're working together with Yes Magazine and others on this new economy. One of the issues that we're focusing on right now that has some great potential is new economic indicators. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the reasons I was out in Oregon was to begin to explore the possibility of Oregon putting in place new economic indicators, so that rather than every economy focusing on growth, and gross domestic product being the only, or gross state product being the only indicator that we use to evaluate whether or not we're headed in the correct direction, we can put in place other indicators, such as what is now in place in the state of Maryland as well as in the state of Vermont, which is something by the name of the Genuine Progress Indicator, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which essentially helps us understand whether or not we are looking at environmental sustainability, social sustainability, as well as economic sustainability, and helps us evaluate policies and progress towards a more sustainable economy. So mm-hmm. Oregon has the potential to put these indicators in place. Right now we're about to release our first study that looks at economic inequality in the state of Maryland. Mm-hmm. And what we found is, like much of the rest of the country, the inequality divide has widened dramatically, and this has had very serious costs, both in terms of cost to the society as well as cost to the environment. And part of addressing the climate crisis will include more fairly evaluating the costs and benefits of, for example, offshore wind versus fracking, you mm-hmm. know, because the short-term thinking is, wow, there's lots of money if we go forward with fracking. And lots of jobs, and that's one of the things that's on the table in the state of Maryland, as well as other states. But when you begin to look at it through a GPI lens, you mm-hmm. begin to evaluate the serious long-term costs in terms of water contamination, in terms of fugitive emissions and climate change, and all of a sudden the cost, the slight costs of offshore wind actually look like benefits. So these kinds of indicators, they are certainly not the only solution, but they're one of a variety of solutions that we're looking at the Institute for Policy Studies in the New Economy Working Group. And if people would like to learn more, they can go to our website, which is ips-dc.org.
And you're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Our guest this morning is Daphne Weisham of the Institute for Policy Studies. And she is explaining that so often when we look at climate change, we say, we throw up our hands and say, what can be done? Or can anything be done? And, you know, we can go through those stages of grief, but eventually we need to get to the sixth stage, which she talks about in an article, and that's doing the work. So give us a call, 503-231-8187. What do you think the president should do to address climate change, and how do you speak to your neighbor and representatives in Congress to convince them that this is something that we need to do yesterday? 231-8187 or moretalkradio@gmail.com, and we'll go to our go to Randy. Good morning, Randy.
Yes, I always go through the stages of grief when I hear people talk about economic inequality.
So what do you think of the suggestion of Ms. Weisham of this GPI as an indicator, as a shift in paradigm in terms of measuring of how we are, the health of a nation?
Oh, I'm sorry. GPI means what?
Genuine progress indicator.
Oh boy, sounds a little scary to me. It depends on who's measuring progress. Because earlier in the conversation, what prompted me to call, I heard you talking about the Koch brothers and the climate deniers and the very clear agenda and keeping students in the dark. That type of language can be applied. You know, I would apply that to you. Koch brothers are a tiny little drop in the bucket compared to the massive left-wing, what do you call those giant organizations that sponsor all this climate so-called, you know, scare tactics and everything.
So Randy, the temperature has not gone up.
The world temperature has not gone up.
Okay, Randy, so climate change isn't something, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you don't think it's an issue that we need to address, and that perhaps some people, as you call left-wingers, are making it more dramatic than necessary?
Yeah, I think it's like she said, a very clear agenda.
Okay, thanks, Randy. So, so Randy is the type of person that we need to talk with, and how do we move Randy and people like Randy to see that this is more than some philosophical dream of such, you know, left wingers?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there are always going to be people that are going to continue to bury their heads in the sand. The fact of the matter is, you know, organizations like myself, like the Institute for Policy Studies, are far from heavily funded. It's just ludicrous to compare our budget with that of the Koch brothers. So I don't even know where to begin with that. In terms of his statement that the temperatures have not risen. He's just not, I'm sorry, he's just not, he's not informed. U.S. average temperatures have increased by about 1.5 degrees since record keeping began in 1895, and more than 80% of this increase has occurred since 1980. The most recent decade was the nation's warmest on record. U.S. temperatures are expected to continue to rise. And this is human-induced warming superimposed on naturally varying climate. So, you know, those are the facts. People can deny them if it makes them feel better. But the thing that I was trying to get at in my my six stages of grief is that I think, you know, beneath the denial, and it's an understandable sentiment, beneath the denial is a feeling of being overwhelmed, like how could this be happening? And you know, I'd much rather just block it out, because blocking it out is easier. It means I don't have to change anything in my way of life. And, you know, we can continue, we can imagine that we can continue to burn fossil fuels forever and ever, but they are a finite resource. And eventually we will have to make a change, whether or not we believe in climate change. It's sort of that ultimately is just one factor that's going to force us to make the change, and the other is that we are dealing with finite resources. Now, focusing on the solutions piece, I was just in Germany and Denmark last fall, and witnessing their energy revolution, and it's very hopeful what they've been able to do. You know, initially they were thinking maybe they could be carbon-free and nuclear-free by 2050 or so. Now they're pushing that back, and they expect to be both carbon and nuclear-free by 2035. And both countries, Germany is largely doing so with solar, Denmark largely with wind. We have vastly far more renewable energy resources than either country. But in terms of climate, Germany compares very closely to the Pacific Northwest. They have very little sun, and yet they are producing most of their energy from sun right now. Mm-hmm. And that's because they have put in place some very innovative programs where they are essentially encouraging people to put solar on their rooftops or in their farms, on their farms, and feed that energy into the grid and then get paid for producing that energy. Mm-hmm. So the average person, they may have to put up, say, $15,000 or something for a solar panel on their roof, but they know exactly how quickly they will get repaid, and therefore that upfront cost is very easy for them to make, because they're guaranteed a rate of return. They'll be paid off in a matter of a few years, and then after that they'll actually make a profit from the solar panels. So that's one model that mm-hmm. Germany has been pushing. It's called a feed-in tariff, and quite a few countries and regions around the world are doing the same thing. Yeah. Another would be something like a carbon tax with a dividend. Mm-hmm. This is another thing that is being discussed, I gather, both in the state of Oregon as well as nationally. And that is where people would pay a slightly higher fee at the pump or perhaps on their utility bill. But if they used less than average, less than the average person in the United States, they would actually get a check back either at the end of the month or once a year. And what that would do is it would incentivize all of us mm-hmm. to actually consume less, and we would actually begin to see a financial return for that energy savings. There are some other ideas that are also part of the mix, including removing taxes, for example, a payroll tax mm-hmm. or other types of corporate taxes in exchange for a carbon fee like this, that would end up not only making the economy stronger, but you know, you would see an increase in certain industries in migrating to regions where these other forms of taxes were reduced. So, mm-hmm. There are a lot of ways of addressing the climate crisis, and there are many ways of doing so and making sure that people aren't just, you know, paying more and more and more, but they're just seeing an economic signal that's encouraging them to move in the direction of a clean energy economy.
Excellent. We're speaking with Daphne Weisham, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Their website is ips-dc.org. My name is Cecil Prescott. Before we go to our next call, let me share with you that coming up this morning at 9 on the OMO Variety Hour, the topics include the 23rd Cascade Festival of African Films, a review of the debut novel of Corey Taylor called Me and Mr. Booker, a personal commentary on being a worker in this society and current issues related to immigration. At 10, hear Air Cascadia with news headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with author Richard Heinberg about the new book, Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews journalist Nathaniel Johnson about his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall speaks with speed skating champion Megan Brichon, who described her ordeals with trauma and eating disorder. Thank you, listeners, and thank you, members, for your support. If you are not a member of KBOO, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the Donate Today. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with Daphne Weisham. We're speaking about climate change, what we can urge the president to do, and how we can speak to our neighbors and congressional representative about this important issue. Give us a call at 503-231-8187 or moretalkradio@gmail.com. And Carolyn, thank you for waiting.
As I was listening to Daphne, I hope I have your name correctly, I was thinking that in the 80s, with the 100 monkey concept, as well as less is more, which actually I understand is a male concept, that this is what you're talking about. And when you mention creating jobs, etc., I think of you talking to SEIU actually at the state level. Their offices are in Salem on Commercial Street. You should either email Rob Fisk or drop by. Our union is doing lots of negotiating with the state right now, but I'm pretty sure he would be pleased to talk with you. I happen to be a home care worker and on the bargaining team on my local 99. I'm hoping that you pursue this as well as do also network with the other unions. We need, as unions, to be able to get together and work together and maybe make some things happen for the people of the state of Oregon. My thought here is it's through going to be coordinated joint effort that we can actually make something productive in terms of what you're talking about become reality.
Hey, thank you so much, Carolyn. And I, one thing that I gained from your remarks is the sense that sometimes unions are made to oppose to those who are concerned about environmental issues. And certainly I think, Ms. Weisham, from my conversation with you and you're looking at new ways of looking at the economy, you don't see these as people on polar opposite sides.
Not at all. You know, I mean, I'm glad that we got the call that we just got, and I just wanted to emphasize that you know, I think what we see in the new economy is an increase in the number of so-called blue-green alliances that are formed to hammer out what we call just transition job programs that would support clean energy. There are a wide array of groups all over the country that are working on that agenda, such as Jobs with Justice, the National People's Action, Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and Van Jones's Rebuild the Dream movement and others. So there are, you know, I think what we are now witnessing in the aftermath of the Occupy Wall Street folks raising the issue of economic inequality in this country is a recognition that we really have, over the last 4 or 5 decades, this country has been experiencing a widening gap in inequality in this, and this has had an effect both on labor, it's had an effect on schools, it's had an effect on our ability to pay for our health care. And we, as part of the transition that we're in the middle of, we are going to need to work on restoring a greater economic equality to this country, because it's really in all of our best interests to have these resources available for all of us as we move forward on the environmental agenda, because it's not either or, it's both. We definitely need to be working together in making sure that all of us are lifted up as we move forward on this agenda. So again, I would encourage people. There's a lot of innovative work out there. For example, one of my colleagues at IPS, his name is Gar Alperovitz. He's leading a new economy working group called the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland. And one of his innovative approaches that he's taking is actually he's working in Cleveland on a worker-owned cooperative that is actually sort of anchored by a hospital in downtown Cleveland, where workers that were otherwise unemployable are now not only running their own businesses, a lot of them are focused on catering to the local hospital, but they are doing so in a way that's solar-powered, that's using minimal chemicals. It's an environmentally sustainable worker-owned cooperative that's got great potential for other communities around the country that are also dealing with unemployment and economic inequality, and you can learn more again by going to our website, which is ips-dc.org. And you know, I think what we're in the middle of is the Great Recession, which is certainly brought down wages and created a you know, an economy that where it's hard to think about how we're going to pull ourselves out and deal with the climate crisis, and yet the two are very much intertwined. And you know, SEIU has been just wonderful on so many of the environmental justice issues that we've been working on over the years, and I see them as part of the solution as we're moving forward. I think they will be key allies. They're one of the nation's largest unions, and so. You know, if I come back to Oregon, and I hope to come back soon, I would love to meet with them.
Great. We'd love to have you back here with us. You're listening to Daphne Wysham, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the founder and co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. And let's hear what our next caller, Lucas, thank you for waiting.
Hey, how's it going, you guys?
Doing well.
Well, I agree with a lot of what I'm hearing on the radio, and especially about cutting back on how much we consume in America. But I think that a very important topic that doesn't get discussed very often with climate change is population control. I just want to know what you think about that, because I just think that part of this consuming less is making sure there's less people on the earth to consume in the future. So I just want to know your opinion on that.
Yeah, you know, we are living through this next century. You know, it's unprecedented, both in terms of population and in terms of all of the environmental problems that are flowing from that population and consumption crisis. I do want to just, you know, I grew up in India, and so I'm well aware of the population issue as well as the gender inequality issue, and I think the two are and have been very closely entwined. You can't address the population issue without also empowering women and girls with good economic opportunities, good educational opportunities, because otherwise it's going to backfire, and it has backfired in parts of India where they have taken a heavy-handed approach of, you know, for example, sterilizing men, and it's resulted in people being very suspicious of any attempts at birth control. What we've learned over decades of looking at this issue is that once a woman is well-educated and can take control of her reproductive cycles, that she is more inclined to delay childbirth and to have a smaller family. And I think we also need to make birth control readily available and hopefully as cheap, if not free, as possible, so that only those who want to have children are having children. I guess that's my sort of general sense, is that yes, the population issue is an important issue, but it's not the only issue, and certainly what we've also learned is that in the United States, where we have a smaller population, we're consuming far more than our share of resources than countries in the global South, where poverty is really an overriding factor. So getting these countries sort of up to a higher standard of living can also mean an additional consumption of resources, and the challenge there is how do we bring the rest of the world up to a higher standard of living while also ensuring that we don't destroy our environment. And that's one of the problems that a lot of folks are dealing with the world over. Yeah. I think the clean energy economy is one of the solutions, not the only one, but one of the solutions that we need to focus on.
Thank you. We'll go to our next caller. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, Cecil, and hi, Daphne. I have an idea. It turns out that you get a lot of rain up there, so my idea is the aqua solar panel. It turns out that now we have these tablets and cell phones, and they have a transparent piezoelectric touchscreen. When people tap on their tablets, they're actually generating electricity. And there was a university that made a piezoelectric rooftop, so during a rainstorm, all the raindrops overnight produced a lot of electricity. So this would be a transparent piezoelectric cover instead of a regular cover on a solar panel, so that it turns all the rain into electricity as well. And it turns out that solar cells, which are cobalt blue or black or gray in color, usually get very hot, so a thermoelectric substrate underneath the photovoltaic cells would turn the excess heat into electricity. So this would be a piezoelectric photovoltaic thermoelectric solar panel called the aqua solar panel for places that get a lot of rain.
Wow.
Well, it sounds like you need to patent that idea.
Yeah.
Well, the technology's here. I'm just telling you, just putting it together in a new way. So
maybe somebody
out there wants to do it. I don't know. I'm busy generating ideas, but the aqua solar panel for Portland, for Seattle, where it rains a lot.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah, sounds like a great idea.
It's
well,
all,
hopefully one
Google.
Of your listeners will jump on that idea and get it off the ground. It sounds like a great one.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for the show.
Hey, thank you. And Harvey just reinforced for me the possibility that although we face this challenge, as you suggest, that there are things that we can do that we can transform our world. We only have a few minutes, and we've only touched on a few of the things I wanted to talk about. Let me just ask you quickly. We talked about the president and his and speaking about climate change. Has the president decided on a new EPA administrator yet? And if not, what can we do about that?
Yeah, well, that's going to be a very key appointment. Lisa Jackson has been outstanding in many ways in terms of resisting a lot of pressure from those who don't want to see any action on climate change. Mm-hmm. She hasn't been, you know, flawless. I think those of us who are, for example, we were concerned about the use of dispersants in the BP disaster, but. So replacing Lisa Jackson, we need to watch for exactly, you know, what the pushback is going to be from the right, from those who don't want to see environmental regulations enforced. A key regulation in the fight against climate change is the Clean Air Act, mm-hmm. and upholding the Clean Air Act and its power to regulate CO2 as a pollutant, as the Supreme Court has ruled it can do. That's one action that Obama could take without any movement by Congress. He mm-hmm. could just move forward on regulating CO2, especially from the highest emitting sources of CO2. And so we want to look for an EPA administrator that is as fearless, if not more so, than Lisa Jackson. We also need to keep the pressure on Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. Mm-hmm. That decision will be made probably by John Kerry and the State Department in a matter of weeks. We also need to be thinking in the Pacific Northwest, you have the coal export terminals that yes. are being planned. There's been a very valiant and well-organized pushback against these coal export terminals, and I think that's one way in which people in the Pacific Northwest can get involved in the climate struggle is to keep the pressure on. We don't need to be exporting coal. It's going to countries like China that are burning coal more cheaply because we're providing it so cheaply from mm-hmm. the Pacific Northwest. And the emissions from the coal, including the mercury and other things, are going to be raining down on the Pacific Northwest. So there's all sorts of reasons why people in the Northwest should get involved in that struggle and push back against that.
And
I don't know if you have other questions.
Well, I do, but we're running out of time. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us. And again, the website for IPS is ips-dc.org.
Yes.
And
we've got a wealth of information up there, and I encourage people to review all of our various projects and get involved if you'd like.
Hey, thank you so much, Ms. Weisham, for joining us. You have been listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Have a good day.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Portland premiere of Who Bombed Judy Berry at the Clinton Street Theater, Wednesday, February 13th. The film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Berry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, More information may be found at kboo.fm/Barry2013.
You're listening to KBOO. This program has been made impossible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications, details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. I am Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Carlos Chavez is our engineer. The Old Mole is an hour-long variety of reviews, interviews, commentary, and analysis from a radical socialist feminist perspective. We are a collective labor that you can learn more about by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show starts out with Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleinman of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos de Noroeste, a union for all of Oregon's farmers' workers. They talk in this first of a two-part interview about new directions and actors in Congress pushing for immigration reform. They consider the growing importance of immigrants as a political bloc in the U.S. and how Latinos figure into this growing demographic in particular. Bookmole Larry Bolden reviews Corey Taylor's debut novel, Me and Mr. Brooker, a coming-of-age novel about a 16-year-old girl from a boring small town and the much older Mr. Brooker, who seems to promise a much more exciting life. Jan Hawken, one of our movie moles, talks with P.C. Perry about the 23rd Cascade Festival of African Films. P.C. is a committee member who is helping to organize this and tells us about the festival's purpose and present offerings. Then, in the latter half of the show, Ivan Hale reflects on her experience of work and the wage system. And then I read a commentary about business unions and how they constrain a visionary labor movement. But now, let's turn to Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman of PICUN, Oregon's Farmers Unions. Bill?
Larry Kleinman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Larry Kleinman is the Secretary-Treasurer of PICUN, Oregon's Farm Workers Union. For the last several years, he's shuttled between Woodburn and Washington, D.C., and all points east and west, working with building networks of what's called the Alliance for Citizenship, the umbrella organization advocating for immigrant rights. Larry, at this moment, it looks like a good possibility of comprehensive immigration reform. The dream is coming to fruition, the product of work by you and so many others. Larry Kleinman, what